And welcome back to Fully Equipped, Golf.com's gear-focused podcast, where we take weekly PGA Tour news and relate it to golfers of all skill levels. I'm Tim Briand, Executive Vice President of True Spec Golf, joined by Jonathan Wall, Managing Editor for Equipment for Golf.com, and Andrew Tursky, Senior Equipment Editor for Golf.com as well. Gents, episode 50, 1 year into Fully Equipped. How about that, huh?
It doesn't even feel like it's been 50 episodes. That to me, I think, shows you how much fun we've had with this. You know, that's...
has been a blast, hasn't it?
It's a testament to how much fun you can have when you're just talking gear. So, yeah, episode 50. We've got a couple, some fun things lined up for this one.
It's only been like 3 months for me, but...
That's right. So you were spared all the aggravation at the beginning, Andrew, where we were, our locations for where we recorded when we started out doing this were pretty wild, as Jonathan, I'm sure, has told you.
I know the struggle of starting out a podcast and not really having it all set up in a studio and stuff like that. So I hear you.
Yeah, it was interesting first 3 or 4 months for sure, but it's great to get to 1 year in on Fully Equipped. All of our listeners out there who've supported us and reached out, thank you so much for all your support. We hope to tee up a nice episode for you here for episode 50. We've got three different tour topics from last week, one regarding Matthew Wolff. We've got a Ricky Fowler equipment issue to discuss. We'll also talk about Kevin Kistner making a small change on his putters. And then for a little change of pace, instead of having interview guests like we typically do, where we interview either a tour player or a teacher or a club designer, for episode 50, we're going to let all you listeners get to know us, your hosts, a little bit better. And we're going to kind of have a little interview roundtable between myself, Andrew Tursky, and Jonathan Wall. So it should be a fun episode. We do have a couple of giveaways, so make sure you stay tuned. We've got some wedges that we're giving out from Cleveland, and we've also got a special promotion.
Let's talk about them now, Tim. I'm excited. Let's do it.
So wedge giveaway. What do you got, Jonathan? Give the people what they want.
Yeah, I know. I mentioned this at the tail end of last week's episode, and I was wondering how many people were going to actually listen to the bitter end to hear the giveaway we had coming up. But Cleveland was kind enough to offer up three sets of their new RTX Zipcore wedges. So now you're thinking giveaway, wedges, you're not just getting one wedge here, you're getting three. So, you know, when you consider that these wedges are pretty pricey, that's a pretty nice little giveaway there. So we're going to be giving away one set each, for those who are on Twitter, one for those who are on Instagram, and then also a set of wedges on Facebook. So if you're not on all three platforms, you know that you can at least enter to win one of those sets of wedges there. These are the brand new wedges that Cleveland has coming out. And Tim's showing it right now. It's got a clean look. We talked about him in depth on last week's episode. This is going to be the new wedge that you're going to be seeing out on the PGA Tour in the bags of guys. Like, is Hideki going to use this wedge? Maybe. Keegan Bradley? You know, I think Graham McDowell. I mean, there are a lot. We can keep going down the list here. But the big story here is that you are going to have a chance to win a brand new set of Cleveland RTX Zipcore wedges. So the giveaway is going to be going live on Wednesday night. So this is going to be coming out on Thursday. So go take a look at the golf.com Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram accounts and get entering. And hey, if you're on all three platforms, gives you some better odds to go win. So that's definitely one to be excited about.
Three sets of three wedges. That's a big old giveaway. Let's go.
Yeah, for sure.
That's exciting.
Looking at these wedges, they look beautiful. We'll be doing a lot of content around this wedge launch over the next few weeks. But thank you to our friends over at Strixon Cleveland Zexio for donating three sets of wedges to our listeners. So make sure that you hit those social accounts and you'll get a crack at winning a set of these. Like Jonathan mentioned, it's a full set of Gap, Sand, and Lob wedge. So not just one wedge going out to the winners. It's a full set. So
you might be able to use them for what you're going to mention next, Tim.
That's exactly right. So The next giveaway, actually, you know what? I'm going to hold back on that one until after we get through tour segments.
Oh, man.
The cliffhanger.
Wow.
Timmy Cliffhanger.
Wow.
Let's get into our segments for the week. We have Matthew Wolf changing shafts out there, changing shafts throughout his irons. Sounds like he went from a Modus 130 into a Project X 6.5. A lot to this story, actually. When tour professionals change iron shafts, usually that's a big deal, because usually when players find an iron shaft that they like, regardless of the head product, they tend to stay in that iron shaft for a while anyways. It's rare to see folks change. So seeing him go from a Nippon 130X to a PX Project X 6.5, that's a fairly significant change. What other information do we have here on this shaft change?
Yeah, you know, this is just coming from work that Matthew's done with his instructor, George Gankis, who we've had on the podcast. And, you know, one of the things that they've had kind of been working on was trying to get a bit more launch with the irons in Matthew's bag. Particularly, he was looking for some more spin when it came to those little half shots that a lot of these tour players are having to hit as they go down in the set. And so, you know, he just wasn't noticing that spin rate that he needed with the Nippon shafts. And he first tried out the Project X 7.0. And look, Matthew Wolf is a strong dude. You know, maybe not Bryson strong, but he can definitely move the ball. And so, you know, it's an obvious choice. If you're in Nippon 130Xs, you know, if you're going to try and go apples to apples, PX 7.0 would seem to be an obvious choice. Still wasn't getting the spin. So he went down to the 6.5, which for those of you out there who play Project X or have tested it, I mean, PX 6.5 is still a pretty stout golf shaft. So, you know, even for a guy like Matthew Wolf, it seemed to be a pretty good compliment, and it ended up giving him that spin in the launch conditions that he was looking for throughout the bag, but particularly, as I mentioned, on those half shots. And as Tim, as you already brought up, you know, when it comes to iron shafts, this is not like, you know, changing out a utility iron or even a driver, which can be fairly easy. I mean, when tour pros start testing out iron shafts, it's usually a pretty lengthy process. And that's why, you know, when you see a guy like Matthew Wolf switching from Nippon to Project X, you know, it's not something that he just kind of did on a whim. You know, all that work that he's been doing with Gankis and the numbers that he was seeing, it made sense to him to make that switch. And lo and behold, look what happens. He finishes runner up. It's his best finish since last season when he won his maiden tour title. And I think it just kind of goes to show you that spin is important. Yes, low spin, we talk about low spin all the time, but having the optimal spin with your irons, you know, that leads to that trajectory and control that you really need to see, especially for a tour pro who's having to really dial it in on the ground of the greens.
Absolutely. And when you look at those two products, you know, you're talking about one's stepped, one's non-stepped. When you look at flight profile and performance characteristics, it's interesting because the Nippon Modus line is a little different. They're 120 gram offering, so they make 120 gram shaft. And that's actually a very flat, low ball flight, low launching, low spinning product. Of all the different steel products out there, it's one of the lowest, flattest products that you can use. But then when you graduate to the 130 gram product, the ball flight's actually quite high. And that's pretty unusual. So usually as you go up in weight, you go down in ball flight. With the case of the Modus 120 compared to the 130, the 130 actually flights a little bit higher than the 120, which is, you know, unusual. That's a very rare characteristic of a lighter weight shaft. And by no means do I think that 120 grams is lightweight, but it's just lighter than 130. So what I would say here is that brands tend to have profiles as far as trajectories and flights. When we're talking about shafts, it's so player dependent in the way that players load the shaft. When you look at Matthew's swing, he doesn't have a lot of wrist hinge at the very top of his swing. And then as he starts his downswing, he adds a tremendous amount of wrist hinge as he starts down. He's got some unique dynamics as far as, you know, his transition And then as he starts to swing down into the ball through his delivery, which are unique to him because of what he does with George Gankus instructionally and kind of what they believe in as far as swing philosophy and what they're trying to do. So he tends to exert a lot of force on the shaft in addition to swinging really fast. So he would be a guy like Fowler that exerts a lot of force on the shaft and swings really fast, as opposed to guys that may not exert as much force on the shaft, even though their club head speed is really high. So in general, you'd be looking for products that are more stable for a player like that. That being said, you know, when you look at him starting off with the Project X 7.0 and then going into a 6.5, obviously that 6.5 product is going to be a little looser, which is going to cause a little bit more more spin. And once again, we see a tour player that's gravitating towards higher spin rather than lower spin. And I think that this is something you see out of Tiger. It's something you see out of a lot of elite ball strikers, that they actually want to maximize spin and then use technique to try to take spin off the shot, but they don't want the equipment to undermine their ability to create different shots and different profiles. So, you know, being that this change was made in the middle of the year, you know, something tells me that they've probably been working on this pretty extensively over these last few weeks while everybody was at home during you know, coronavirus pause. But it'll be interesting to see how Matthew uses these going forward. From my read on it, he's looking to hit it a little bit higher with a little bit more spin, gain a little bit of shot shaping control. And then the thing that you'd have to be careful of is that in windy conditions that it's spinning too much. So does going to this option, you know, in a very breezy environment, is that going to handicap the player as opposed to, you know, helping them? So be interesting to see how this story evolves over the next few weeks. And with that, let's get into our second iron story for the week. This has to do with Ricky Fowler. I saw Ampcell irons in the bag. What's going on here?
Yeah, this is I think it even threw me for a little bit of a loop. I actually thought the initial photos were, you know, if you search Getty Images, and if you're, you know, again, a true Getty pro here, let me tell you about how to search Getty Images. If you search Getty and you go by name, sometimes it'll give you the most relevant photos, the most popular ones for whoever you're searching for. And it has thrown me for a loop before. I'm like, whoa, what is Tiger doing with a driver from 5 years ago? Oh, wait.
Gotta go new.
Gotta go new. It still throws me for a loop. I really thought these that's what I thought happened here with this photo. But yeah, Fowler with the Cobra Ampcell Pro irons. And, you know, I think a lot of people automatically go, well, hold up a second. Didn't he just put a set of RF prototype blades, a set of irons that Cobra designers made 33 revisions to before landing on a final version for Ricky Fowler? And he's now going back to irons that are 7 years old. You know, it's got to be the irons. It can't be anything else. And so, thankfully, having some great connections, reached out to Ben Showman, who's Cobra's tour rep. And Ben set the record straight on these. This is not Ricky Fowler going back to an old set of irons because he was frustrated with those RF prototypes. It's actually Ricky kind of being economical, which, you know, you think about tour pros and all the product that they get. It's probably easier for a lot of these guys to just call up their rep and say, hey, can you send me a set of irons with a set of shafts? But Ricky being Ricky, he was testing some different shafts and tried out this set of Ampcell Pro irons with a True Temper Dynamic Gold X100 Tour issue shafts. He's played.
That's what he had in there when he was playing.
Yeah,
right?
but more recently, so he was X1, but remember he went to S400s. In his irons last year at, I believe it was Valero. I think I was actually there. I should know, but I'm pretty positive.
But it wasn't in those. It wasn't in those Correct. Irons. Like the last time he played the Ampcell yep. irons, he was playing the
X1s. He's playing the X1s. Yeah. Exactly. So this is not, as you mentioned, this is not a shaft that he's unfamiliar with, but because the RF prototype irons that he has, those aren't in plentiful supply. If it took Cobra designers 33 revisions to come up with a set they probably don't have another, you know, couple of sets laying around. So instead of sending these irons back in and saying, hey, pull these shafts out or put new shafts in these RF heads, because he doesn't know. He's just doing some testing at home in preparation for the majors. He has a set of KBS Tour C-Taper S plus 125s in his current set of RF prototypes, but he just wanted to test out this X100 Tour Issue shaft in a game setting. And so that's why he brought these irons with him to the tournament. It was just to simply test them, see if the shafts work. And you know, he played really well, and I think that was one of the things that he was just looking to see, is did the shafts make a difference? Because for the most part, these heads.
Do you think that's a true story, Jay Wall? In your opinion?
Yeah.
Like, you don't think he could just put in X100s in the in some,
you know,
new heads? Or do you think he was looking at going backwards? In the head, maybe he didn't love
it. Just
the
revision to me seems really irons. Weird that he would go all the way back to Amcel Pro. You know, that's so far back. And, you know, I think back to, we've talked about it before on the show, how particular tour pros are when it comes to their set builds. You know, some guys can notice little differences. You know, I'm not sure if Ricky ever tested. I should have asked Ben this. I'm not sure if he ever even tested the RF prototypes with the next one shaft. I'm guessing not, because he you know, that really probably wasn't on his radar at the time. So I think he just kind of wanted to see what happened before they went to the trouble of building another set. And then look, Ben Showman's one of the nicest, most honest dudes out on tour. He's not the kind of guy who's going to give me any sort of like spin. So I'm sure there are people that are maybe skeptical when they read that, but Ben is not that kind of guy to just do it to simply save Cobra. It's just simply, again, Ricky trying to find a new iron shaft, and he just didn't want to tear apart his new RFs.
So that actually makes sense based on a conversation I had yesterday with somebody on the shaft side of the industry. A prominent shaft designer had mentioned that Ricky is doing some shaft testing, not just in the irons, but throughout the bag. And so your explanation, Jonathan, as far as Ben's, you know, what he's saying was the precipice for going back to these irons, sounds actually right to me. That it sounds like he's testing shafts with his old gamer set, because at the end of the day, I mean, the old gamer set is what he knows as far as performance better than anything else. So it's a really good control to test new product off, because he knows the way that these things perform inside and out. So when he changes a shaft and tests them in the old gamer set, he's going to see the difference in performance between that shaft more so than he would out of anything that's new, because he understands the way that those old gamers play so well.
He did change driver shafts.
Is that how
too.
You recommend shaft testing, though? Because, I mean, the way like a shaft marries, the way a shaft marries with a head in the CG.
At the initial phase of testing, yeah, you're going to try to isolate variables as much as you can. Yes, you do make a great point that differences in CG and differences in head design means that a shaft could be a little bit better in one head versus another head. But from a very general perspective, you're going to know if you're in the right ballpark as far as a shaft, if you're testing with a head that you're familiar with. So I always tell folks, it makes the most sense when you test product to use a controlled setting where you're not just throwing a bunch of paint up on the wall to see what sticks. So if you're changing club head variables and shaft variables simultaneously, how do you know what's really moving the needle? Is it the shaft, or is it the head, or is it both? So it's a little bit better way to understand why performance is changing if you're just isolating one variable at a time when you're changing. And when I say variable, I don't just mean the shaft. I mean, if I want to test a different length shaft, I would want to test the exact same shaft at two different lengths. I wouldn't want to test shaft A, which could be, you know, a Project X65, and then compare that to a half inch longer Modus 130. That's not an apples to apples test. So whenever you're trying to test and fit for variables, you want to isolate to the only variable you're trying to test when at all possible, especially at the beginning of the process. When you get further down the line, you start to understand that these couple of shafts and these couple of heads work well. Then at that point, it's about the marriage between the specific shaft and the headpiece, if that makes any sense. So
And Fowler switched into, just to mention here briefly, he switched to LA Golf in the driver shaft. So it's
He did switch back, though, I saw. Switched back right away, I thought.
No, he had the LA Golf shaft.
I don't think he played. Did he actually play with the LA Golf shaft in the tournament? I don't think so, yeah.
He gamed around with it and then switched back to his old trusty in the driver shaft, from what I understand. But just speaks to the fact that there's a lot of shaft testing going on in the world of Ricky Fowler right now. As I mentioned earlier, you've got driver shafts being tested, iron shafts being tested. So it seems to me like a month or so from now, this may be a bigger story that he's been making some changes throughout his entire set as far as different shafts that he's playing. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. And with that, we've got a third topic of the week, which is a Kevin Kisner putter change. I'm not really sure what's going on this story here, guys. What do you have for us?
Yep. So Kevin made a pretty subtle change, but I think, again, we always try and relate the tour news to the everyday golfer. You know, Kiz has been looking for a putter, which is crazy because he's kind of one of those sneaky guys where if you were to say name some of the oldest putters on tour, you know, you're probably first going to say Tiger Scotty. You know, Spieth's Cameron, Sneds with his Rossi, and Kiz has been using an Odyssey White Hot Pro number 7 for, I mean, it feels like eons. I've posted photos of the putter before on social, and it is worn out. I mean, the entire sole is completely gone. But he struggled a little bit with the flat stick and decided to go to an Odyssey Exo. And if you're not familiar with the Exo, it kind of has like it says, an exoskeleton design to it, and it was kind of meant to move weight around and just give it a really unique look. And they made it in a number 7 head shape, and Kevin put the putter in play 1 week prior and had three dots on the top line, which is kind of his calling card. But you just didn't really feel like he was kind of being able to match up consistent contact with proper speed. It just felt like his speed controls was a little bit out of whack. And for Kevin, all it took was adding two white lines, one on each side of that. If you're familiar with the 7, that winged mallet, it's got with the EXO, it's a little bit straighter on the interior portion, and they were able to add one white line to each side to kind of frame up the head when it's out of dress, and that's all it needed. And it's funny because Kevin has been using the White Hot Pro number 7 I mentioned for so long, you would have thought that he would have kept everything apples to apples with the alignment, but he decided to just go with three dots, which he had on his old putter, but he left off the lines initially. And it just goes to show you, sometimes it takes something as little as adding a couple of alignment lines to help get you back on track. And Tim, you know, you're the putter guru here. I heard you helped somebody out. I was debating whether I was going to even mention this because I didn't want to make your ego any bigger than it is. But one of the TrueSpec employees, Doug Smith, gave you some props for a tip you gave him recently. The putter guru, you certainly, he told me you helped him out big time. So when it comes to putters, I would think that if you were going to try something new, even if you're having success with your old putter, you'd probably want to try and find something that had a similar alignment just to try and, you know, reduce the number of unknowns and as you're testing. What do you think? I mean, that's what it kind of leads me to believe here with Kevin.
What do you use, J-Wall? What's on the top of your putter? Do you use a top line, a flange line, side dot?
I use a flange line. I used to use a side dot, but I've kind of found that flange line for me is the easiest way to kind of get myself lined up properly to the target.
Tursky?
I have a flange line on my Scotty, but it's covered with lead tape, so it's just like an indentation. It's not a different color or painted different or anything, but I can see the line. That's all you need.
Flange line for the win. There.
So yep. This is a lot of work that if you look at David Adele and Adele putting in conjunction with David Orr, who we've had on our podcast and is a very good friend of mine, David Orr and David Adele spent quite a bit of time with Adele Golf looking into what I call it the alignment package or optical package of a putter and seeing how that affected things. And the idea is that if you aim better, you'll putt better. Now, that's a whole different topic for another day as far as aims correlation to performance. You could argue both for and against it, but fact of the matter is when you're talking about flange line, dots, top line, combinations, multiple dots, nothing at all of this plays into the way that players see, and it plays into their optics. Now, generally, the longer and more prominent the line is, and the number of lines, meaning 3, 4, 5 lines on the putter versus one. So the length of the line and the number of lines on the putter, especially when they're on the flange line, will tend to make a player aim more left or a little bit more closed. Now, this isn't every player. There are some players that may not aim a flange line left relative to one without it. And that's the important thing to understand here. This is all other things being equal. So if the offset's the same, if the head shaping is the same, if the color on the head is the same, if everything is the same about the head and the only difference on the head is having a flange line versus no flange line, most players are going to aim the flange line putter a little bit more closed. Now, as far as the way it affects the stroke, you mentioned something completely different there, Jonathan, where Kiz felt like it really framed the ball. And this is something I remember hearing out of Justin Rose a few years back when he was coming off of his TaylorMade contract, was looking into, I remember he said, you know, frankly, every time I pick up Hedrick Stenson's putter, I make everything I look at. And so he obviously, Stenson meaning, uses a number 7, and he had lines that were going, you know, down the length of that fang to provide those parallel flange lines. And a lot of players, when they see those lines towards the heel and toe of the putter, where it kind of frames the striking area, for whatever reason, they feel like that changes their stroke dynamics. I haven't done much research nor seen much research to state whether that's true or not. I can tell you that, you know, when I see those two really spread out flange lines going back and forth in my putting stroke, I do understand the perception that some of these tour players have where they feel like their putting stroke is better when they go to these alignment lines. But what I would say to players is this, you know, the alignment package that's on your putter, for regular retail putters, we're somewhat limited. You do have different brands out there like Toulon, like Adele, some of the more custom premium putter brands, where you can customize the sight dots or alignment lines. But for the most part, if you're buying off the rack, and even if you are buying a customized putter, a lot of us don't have access to getting different sight dots and different alignment packages put on there. Is it worth your time to find out what you putt better with? Absolutely. So the question I have for you guys is, have you ever done any in-depth testing on testing putters that were exactly the same, with the only difference basically being the alignment package? So have you tested the same exact type of putter you're playing, J-Wall, with a different alignment package?
Yeah, I have.
I actually got tested by Adele at the PGA show one year, and same head style, like probably 7 different alignment lines. And the one with 3 lines on top was by far the best for me. It like inches. I was like inches off with other alignment lines. So, I mean, I don't use it in my putter. I basically ignored it, but.
Do you have to aim it really, really well to be a great putter? And the answer to that is no, you don't. There's a lot of research that states that those who aim it best tend to also perform the best, and that there's a correlation. But it's important to understand that a correlation and causation are two different things. So aiming straighter does not cause you to putt better. It just happens to be one of the characteristics that better putters have in common. We find examples of fantastic putters that don't aim it anywhere close to the center of the hole. Case in point, what tour pro out there do you think aims 2 degrees right of his target? Yeah, there you go. So Tiger's aiming 2 degrees. He's aiming 2 degrees right of his target.
Kepka aims right,
a lot of players do. A lot of players aim right, and then they close the face dynamically through their stroke. Now, it's important to understand that the face is closed relative to the path or relative to the arc. But relative to the target line, it's still pretty square, okay? So, but when we're talking about alignment lines, dots, where they're located, you can do your own little internal testing on this. The one thing that I have to caution the average listener to is make sure that every other feature of the putter is exactly the same, meaning that the length is the same, the lie angle is pretty darn close, the shape of the head is similar. You want to make sure that the offset and the neck style in the putter is similar. And if you have access to be able to test two different putters with different alignment packages, it's going to tell you which one you aim closer to the center of the hole. I would always advise doing this with a second person, just that they're a second set of eyes. You're probably not going to believe the second set of eyes when they tell you the truth about where you're aimed. But the point is that when we're standing in an address position for our putter, our optics are not optimized in order to see an accurate representation of the line for most people. So a lot of our perception when we're standing in the ball from the address position on the putter, our perception of what the line is and what the line actually is, a lot of times there's a huge disconnect. And that's the whole purpose of trying to figure out the alignment line on the putter. I use the analogy, it's like getting a fancy scope for Grandpa's gun. Grandpa's gun tends to shoot to the left, so you better aim to the right. Well, what these different alignment lines are doing on the putter is it's kind of like adding a scope to a rifle that builds in a little bit of offset, aiming left or aiming right, based upon where Grandpa's gun shoots, if that makes any sense. So,
or you could just be like...
Shout out, Grandpa.
Yeah, or you could just be like Jason Day and go with no sight line. Yeah, and he's kind of the one guy that when we're talking about sight lines, he's the guy who I go to as the polar opposite. You know, I remember a few years back he switched into an old TaylorMade Spyder Itsy Bitsy, and when he switched to that putter, I asked him about it, and he said the reason why he went back to it was because it didn't have a line. He basically found that he was relying too much on the sight line on top of the putter head to kind of line him up, and he said removing it kind of freed him up. And so don't, I guess I'm kind of being devil's advocate here, but also saying that if you struggle with alignment and you can't seem to find a line, don't be afraid to just remove it and go with something that's clean and try and go more with feel instead of just trying to get so mechanical, trying to hit your spots with an alignment line. So anyway, that's my final piece of advice with the putter.
I just want to say before we move on from the Kisner putter topic, I know we kind of got off, but we're still on the Kisner topic. I just got to shout out his old putter, which has the coolest placement of a custom stamping of all time.
Oh, yeah, the little kids.
It's like behind the hosel. Yeah, the little kids, right? Like, it's in the craziest spot. You got to go to, I think you posted it on Fully Equipped Golf on Instagram. Yep. So go to our Instagram page and check that out. Kiz has a pretty cool stamping I think you'll appreciate. But we can move along now. Just had to throw that in.
Yes, sir. So with that, I think that it's time for us to get into a little roundtable interview session. But before we get into that, I do want to announce a little giveaway for True Spec Golf. So for all of our listeners out there who have not had a chance to come see us at True Spec, we are offering 50% off of fitting fees for any fully equipped listener. So
50% for the 50th episode.
That's right. 50 for 50. So the way to redeem that is just call in to our 800 number, 844-729-8809. Or you can email us, info@truespecgolf.com. And you can also find us on the web if you want to book online. TrueSpecGolf.com, as I mentioned earlier. And all fittings will be offered at 50% off. You just need to use the promo code FE50, and that's between now and August 31st. So
FE, the number 50?
Exactly right. Frank Edward 50. So all you folks out there, if you want to come in and see us at TrueSpec, make sure you give us a call. We'd love to have you and show you what custom fitting can do.
And if you're in Scottsdale, maybe you can get a fitting with the professor himself.
Hey, I'm always here. So
he does decent work. I can vouch.
Get lucky.
I'll vouch for him too. That's why he's the professor.
You know, at this point, we're in episode 50, guys. We're 1 year into this. And we've had a few listeners, you know, that have emailed us, DM'd us, and reached out and said, hey, you know, we'd love to know a little bit about more of your backgrounds for all of us hosts. So I think this is the perfect time to spend a few minutes to just kind of round table a few questions amongst the three of us and get into our backgrounds within the industry. We kind of come from different walks of life, so to speak. But, you know, obviously this industry is very small. So I guess we can get started by grilling Jonathan here, Andrew.
Let's go. Right on the hot seat. Welcome.
We've kind of discussed this before, Jonathan, but how did you find your way into the editorial staff for Golf Magazine and Golf.com? Obviously, you've had some time with PGA Tour and other golf media, but when did you know that you wanted to write about golf as a career?
Oh, man. I mean, I kind of feel like I still am holding on to a golden ticket. You know, one of the cool things is because of what we do get questions a lot about, hey, I'm really interested in the golf industry. How do I get involved? And sometimes it's I sheepishly kind of tell my story. It's kind of one of those, you know, I truly believe in paying it forward. And you know, was supposed to write about NASCAR when I graduated from college, of all things. I was going to be doing the NASCAR beat, for Sporting News, but golf has always been my passion since I've been little, golf and basketball. And you know, I always kind of said 10-year plan was 10 years after being in the journalism field, I wanted to write about golf. I felt like that was realistic, and just happened to get lucky. Jason Sobel read something that I had it was actually a critical analysis piece on something that he had written, and he emailed me, and we kind of went back and forth, and I said, I might as well just shoot my shot. And he told me that Golf Digest had an opening, and that was kind of my in. I sent my resume along, went up for a meeting, and got an offer, and went from writing about NASCAR to writing about golf. So yeah, I mean, it was just kind of crazy how it's been like a little bit of a winding road to get to the gear. It was just simply having been in the industry. I was writing about tour news and more mainstream topics. And one of my old bosses from Golf Digest actually had moved over to the PGA Tour, and he said, "Hey, we've got this job opening, and it's writing about gear." And we've never had anybody ever cover gear for us full time and kind of get to make it your own. And that's exciting. You know, I think we've all kind of been in that position where you get an opportunity to try and build something from the ground level. And so I said, yeah, I'm in. I was writing golf at Yahoo Sports at the time and took the jump to the tour, and it was an awesome opportunity, and had a chance to kind of build the tour's presence in the gear spotlight. And you know, 6 years after that, Golf Magazine came calling with an offer that was too good to refuse. And I think the one thing I will say for people that really want to write about gear, I mean, yes, it's a very small group. It's a niche within a niche sport is the kind of the way that I describe it. And look, you just have to be passionate, and you got to have a little bit of luck. I am always willing to answer any and all questions via email. Get them all the time from soon to be college grads and those that have recently gotten out of school. So if you ever got any questions, I'm always here to answer them. And again, still feel super lucky to be in the position that I'm in. I certainly don't take it for granted.
I think my biggest advice, like in that vein, is kind of just to go for it. Like, it doesn't really matter what your degree is, especially in the field of journalism. Like, you know, there's a lot of different stuff going on with writing and backgrounds and stuff like that.
Yep.
But if you want to work for a Digest or a golf magazine, whatever it is, maybe it's ESPN, just start reaching out to people. Start your own blog and, you know, get some examples to send to people. And just chase it, like, just go for it, because people aren't going to hold you back. You know, I think there's really people that, like you and like me, who want to help out and get people exactly into the career that they want, yep. You know?
And that's the important thing, is just to remember that don't be afraid to reach out, even if it's somebody like an Adam Schefter or I've reached out to a lot of high profile journals before, just asking for advice on stuff, especially when I was just starting out. And you'll be surprised how many of them will respond to emails. You know, they get tons of social media DMs and stuff like that from people that are peppering them with questions. But it's funny how if you take the time to write a thoughtful email, how more people out there that are in positions of power in the journalism industry will take the time to respond. So don't be afraid to reach out.
Email's the biggest thing. Yeah. Trying to dive in DMs doesn't always work.
It's a beating. You know, it's I don't even really read mine.
Whether they even see it, whether they even see it or not. Yeah, because a lot of mine, they just get caught in like, you have to accept to even see it. And I don't really go in there too much. Yeah. I mean, I try to respond when I can, but email is like the best way to do it. If you can track down someone's email and, like you said, reach out with like a thoughtful, hey, how do I get in the industry? I want to do this. I want to do that. People will respond and they'll take out time.
Tim, you were like a jack of all trades. I mean, before you came to TruSpec, you played big time. Tursky did too. You played big time college golf at South Carolina. What was your first gig out of school?
Well, I played coming out of school, so I played for 3 years.
When did you come to the realization that you just that trying to play pro golf was not going to work?
When I fired a 5-under 67, played really well. Could have converted a few more birdies, but all in all was a good round. And the guy in the group behind me bogeyed the last hole and shot 59. I said, I ain't got it.
Welcome to pro golf, man.
Can't make money doing this. I need to go find something else. So that was kind of the thing. But before, you know, my story's all over the place, man, as far as all the different things in the industry. You pretty much knew you always wanted to get into journalism, though. That was, you know, through school, all your academics were leading you towards that direction. I mean, this was something that you knew pretty, I'd have to assume, early in your college career that you kind of wanted to go down this road.
I mean,
you're talking to Jay Wall, not me.
Well, both of you guys, really, but starting with Jay Wall.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds crazy, and people can call BS, but I mean, I pretty much knew I wanted to be a sports writer going back to when I was in like third grade. I think even back then, it's like you watch pro athletes and you want to grow up and you want to be, you know, Michael Jordan, you want to be Nolan Ryan, but you know, it's just like for me, so I grew up. My dad was in the Air Force and moved around a lot. And we were in DC at one point when he was stationed at the Pentagon. And I used to, and this is going all the way back to third grade, I used to get the Washington Post and the Washington Times, and I would read the sports sections cover to cover every single morning. Would sit down at the table with my cereal. My mom still, I remember my mom called me her little old man because I would read the sports page cover to cover. And we would go out and we would, you know, see some of my dad's friends, mom's friends, and I could talk sports with anybody. And I'm third grade and I knew all the stats, everything. I consumed it all. And so, yeah, I think from an early age, it was just, I loved reading about any and all sports, got all the sports magazines. And it just kind of was that thing. I knew I wanted to be in the industry and figured that one of the best ways to do it was to try and find a passion for writing. And yeah, that was kind of my thing, is going back to third grade. That's the first realization I had.
So Jay Wall, working his childhood dream job, marries his high school sweetheart. This guy's living his best life.
Absolute dream, man. Good for you.
How about you, Andrew? How did you get in? How did you find yourself on the editorial side of the business? Obviously, I know you've got a lot of background in golf, played competitively through college. And like, when did you start to really figure out that the life of the journalist was that you were well suited for it?
I don't know if my mom's going to like me telling this story, but
but it's definitely one to tell.
Yeah. My journalism career took off when I failed out of the business school at Rutgers after 2 years. After 2 years, I was majoring in business.
Blessing in disguise.
And after 2 years to stay in the business school, you had to have a 3.0 GPA. And I had a 2.98. And I took the meeting with whoever like the president of the business school was or whatever. And I was like, is there anything I could do to stay in? Like, you know, I've been super busy with golf and traveling and classes and stuff like that. I know I can pick it up. And he was just like, nope, sorry. I was like, oh my God. Okay. Brutal, man. I just had to think about like really what I wanted to do. And I had always liked writing. I always enjoyed English. I knew I didn't want to do anything with math or statistics or finance or anything like that, which is probably why I failed out of the business school in the first place. So I was like, all right, I'm
200ths off.
Yeah. And then, so I just started taking journalism classes. I really liked it. I like fell in love with, newspaper writing, and I actually really liked, film critiques. I wanted to be a film critic at one point. And, then I was like, no, I'm going to write about golf. So I started writing for, it was MTR Media. I don't even think it exists anymore, but I was writing football, baseball, basketball, golf articles, just kind of finding my voice. And then I went to grad school in Hawaii where I played for a year. And that's when I was just like, I'm not getting a real job on the side. I was like, I got to do something with writing and online and the media. That's what I love. That's kind of my calling. And I just hit up Golf WRX. Shout out Zach Kozahuski for responding back. They just had a little button. It was want to write for us on Golf WRX. And I just hit them up. I had a couple articles on MTR Media and just some other things that I had done that I sent him. And he was like, hey, we need some help doing our what's in the bags. So basically, I was just taking Greg Moore's photos at Golf WRX, turning them into what's in the bag articles, writing here and there. And I just fell in love with the whole process of it and writing equipment and stuff like that. Before, I was always kind of a feel player. I wasn't super into the equipment world. I was more into fashion and shoes and stuff like that. But, golf clubs are very similar to that. It's there's function and there's also fashion. Yeah, there's a lot. So I really like the design aspect of golf clubs, and I just got super into it from there. And then I worked for Golf WRX for 5 years. I moved from Hawaii to Michigan like an absolute idiot, but it was great. It was great for me. And then, five years in, Jay Wall hit me up. I got a job for you at PGA Tour. So I took over his job working the equipment report. And then after a year, he wanted me to join with Golf Magazine. So I guess I owe most of my career to Jay Wall, really. But
if I didn't like you, I wouldn't have considered you for to be my replacement at the tour to join me here.
That's actually a good point, though. Is relationships mean a lot, yep, especially in the golf industry that's so small. I don't want to say Jay Wall was playing favorites, but relationships are huge.
Yeah, I mean, and you want to
whenever you get an opportunity. I would say, yeah, whenever you get an opportunity, no matter where it is, who it is, just grind your butt off, work as hard as you can, put your hat down low, and just grind it out, and people are going to notice. And be nice to people, Be friendly.
Without elaborating, so just the quick hitter list of the prior employers previous to being on the team at Golf Jay Wall, you've got PGAtour.com, you've got who else were you part of the editorial staff before joining golf?
Post graduation, I was Golf Digest straight out of college, Yahoo Sports after that, with a stint helping out with the Dallas Morning News' golf coverage, and then from there to the there's tour, and then
were you
Golf Mag.
Were you writing on your college paper and high school paper and stuff like that? I feel like you were.
Yeah. I didn't. So the crazy thing is I actually didn't write for the paper when I was in high school. I was playing basketball and golf. I just didn't have I didn't have the bandwidth to do it. And I mean,
better at basketball or golf in high school?
Golf eventually.
I got a state championship ring basketball. Shout out Immaculata High School.
not to go off the rails or anything, but I played basketball against guys that you might know some of the names of, Darren Williams, Chris Bosch.
I got a Darren Williams jersey.
Bracey Wright. I mean, the Dallas Fort Worth basketball scene when I was in high school was Jason Maxiel, who played in the NBA. Just some insane guys where you just realize you're not going to go play any sort of college ball. So yeah, that was my thing is I just kind of had sports in high school. And then when I got to college, freshman year on, I was writing for the school paper. But I also, one of the things I will mention for those who are in college, if you're writing for the college paper, make sure you try and get some stringer jobs. I also wrote for the local, the Bryan College Station Eagle. I went to Texas A&M, Giggum. Also wrote, I got lucky, got to write for Sporting News when I was in college. Sports Illustrated had a college edition that I helped write for. I mean, I was crazy busy, really didn't have very much of a social life because I was always writing. So sometimes you have to grind if you got something you really want to do when you graduate.
I think I had too much of a social life, you know. That's why I had that 2.98.
I definitely didn't have a 2.98 in school, that's for sure.
What were you hovering around?
I may have gone to a 2.98 classes during my time in college.
That's average amount of classes per semester, yeah.
That's exactly right. Some semesters I got over a 4.0, baby.
And we call you the professor. That's false advertising.
You don't have to be a good student to be a good teacher, though.
That's true.
Right.
That is true.
Couple quick points on your careers. J-Wall, what would you say is, looking back throughout your time in the industry, what's the one pinch me moment where you were like, all right, this is cool. I really love what I do.
Oh, it's an easy one. I mean,
our answers are going to be the same.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I was coming off of an anniversary trip. It just happened to time up, flew into Miami, wife flew home back to Dallas, and I drove north to Jupiter, and the very next day spent the whole day with Tiger watching him test, and then he and I went one-on-one, and I left there. I've basically saying it's never going to get, I mean, being a gear rider, it's never going to beat that. Nope. It's all downhill from here. I mean, seriously, you just spent a whole
day.
That's
the number one. That's like the number one.
Yep.
You know, interviewing Tiger. That was my number one as well. But I think like getting to play, you know, exclusive courses that you would never play otherwise. Like J-Wall's gotten to play Augusta and Pine Valley. I've played Pine Valley and all sorts of, you know, stuff like that you would just never do as a regular golfer. You know, the people. No, I haven't played Augusta. I don't know if anyone knows.
Keep bringing it up. Keep bringing it up.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I'm over it. I'm over it.
I mean, if you're over it, then do you really want to go to Augusta this fall?
Well, I might as well go. Might as well go. I'll go check it out.
Oh, that's outstanding. All right, so here you go. Another quick hitter for both you guys. The one piece of gear, whether it's a gamer or whether it's in a collection, the one piece of gear that you are never getting rid of, the one that has the most sentimental value, whatever you want to call it, what's the one piece of gear that's the most treasured in your collection?
Probably my first set of golf clubs, the La Jolla, the split set. It's just like, you know, it's your first set.
It's Andrew what started Tursky all. Andrew Tursky still has the pencil still that he used in first grade.
Dude, I got all my scorecards from like before I was 17. Every round I ever played. My first round of golf
he's a candidate for hoarders.
My first round of golf with my dad, like 18 holes, Hillsborough Country Club. I still have the scorecard. Shot like 119, awesome. Something like that. But I was only like 6 years old.
I mean, I'm not super sentimental when it comes to the golf clubs, but I still have my.
You can go with valuable.
Well, I mean, no, but I'll go with Scotty Cameron Newport Torellium. That was really kind of around the time that I got lefty, about the time that I really started getting serious about golf when I was in middle school, and that was kind of the one. I mean, it represents, you know, the win that really kind of catapulted me headlong into wanting to play golf. I mean, can seriously play golf, not just play golf with my dad, but that was Tiger winning the 97 Masters, and he won the Masters with the Torellium, and I still remember him winning, and that was the putter, and I had to have it. So it's never going anywhere. It's definitely a keeper for me. What about you, Tim? Do you have any clubs like that you
I've got my college driver. It's a Cleveland TC Persimmon Wood head. Cleveland TC 15.
Persimmon.
Dynamic old so X100 fun. Shaft with a Golf Pride Victory grip on it. Remember the good old Victory grip?
Oh, yeah.
So I have that in my collection, which I still love. It's still in amazing condition. I've got a wedge that was like my wedge when I was a junior golfer. It was an old Snake Eyes wedge that's been ground. I mean, you can't even tell it's a Snake Eyes wedge anymore. It's been ground so many times, and it's pretty unique looking. And then I would say my old Ping answer putter from junior golf as well, the old Copperhead. Wasn't beryllium or anything fancy like that, but it's definitely an old school answer from back in the day. I'd say those three from sentimental standpoint. From a value standpoint, I've got a couple 7 Dreamer shafts, and I don't know.
Jeez, those things cost a pretty penny.
Those are grand, aren't they?
If you guys, that little corner of my office right over there.
That's where the fire is.
That's where all the fire is. That's where you see some cool stuff. Plus, I've got a bunch of golf clubs over there as well. So my office is a cornucopia of stuff that you're not going to find in a lot of other places. It's kind of neat to have access to all this stuff. Obviously, at TruSpec, we're testing it and considering whether we want to put some of this stuff in our matrix or not. But, you know, as far as valued, those clubs that I used growing up, I think are the ones that, you know, have the most sentimental value to me anyways.
I just remembered this. I remember the driver versus driver show for Wilson.
Course.
During their little promo run, I got to go to the Wilson headquarters and design my own driver, and I have the 3D printout of it.
Oh, really?
I don't know where it is, but I have it.
That's pretty
cool. Yeah, it's so cool. So cool. I had a creative little way to adjust the weight on the bottom. It was like a gear that was half tungsten, half aluminum, I think it was, and you just twist it so you could change the CG. Creative, man. It was illegal, but it was cool.
Tim, how did you end up at TruSpec? I mean, we always talk about it. You're kind of a jack of all trades. You've kind of done it all within the industry.
I've done everything except mow the greens. I have raked bunkers. I have raked bunkers. So for all of us in the industry, whenever you see somebody working in the turf maintenance crew that's working the fly mower, that's the mower that they use to mow down the sides of bunkers. That's the guy that got in the most trouble. That's the person that when you get that assignment, you were probably late for work. I know this firsthand because I was given that assignment more than enough times throughout my time in the industry. But
that's great.
Yeah, as far as things I've done, I've worked on the R&D team. I've worked on the fitting team, sales team. I've worked as a golf instructor, obviously spent time as a player. So I've done a lot of different things, spent time as a general manager at a private club. So, you know, it's kind of all over the place, quite frankly.
Checking all the boxes. Wow.
Yeah, I actually ended up with that general manager position, ended up having to become a sommelier so that I could run the restaurant.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So
we got to hear some stories from that. Come on.
That was a lot of fun, and a lot of very influential people went through that dining room regularly. So, yeah, as Jonathan mentioned, I've done just about everything in the industry. How did I get into fitting? You know, I spent some time after recognizing that I wasn't good enough to play competitively, spent some time on an R&D team with one of the major brands at the time. And we've discussed this before on the pod, back with the Spalding R&D team. So that was Spalding, Ben Hogan, Strata, and Top Flight. And there were some really into Tonic actually back in the days. Who remembers a Tonic shoes? But
yep, I had a pair of white ones. I loved them.
When you look at that R&D team from that time period, late 90s, early 2000s, there were a lot of really, really influential people nowadays in the design part of the industry, whether it's Garen Reif, Mike Taylor, Tom Stites, Rick Sheets. All these guys that are very prominent in the design world, we're all part of that same R&D team. So bottom line is, spent some time working on the R&D team with that organization. From there, got into teaching, had a really good career teaching golf, working with some really high-level junior players that went on to win state juniors and state amateur championships. A couple of those players went on to national championship golf teams in college. And then I kind of looked back, you know, spent some time as a general manager at a private high-end club up on Martha's Vineyard. Also spent time as a first assistant at Seminole Golf Club down in Juneau Beach, Florida, as well as the country club up in Brookline, Mass. So kind of been around the upper echelons of the industry for a long time. When I started to look at it and I said, well, you know, my experience in the green grass side of the world, whether it's being a general manager at a club, providing amazing experiences, or being a teacher, then you look at the experience in the design side of the world, having been close to so many great club designers, it's like, well, what kind of is the perfect marriage between all of this? And quite frankly, it's club fitting. There's a little bit of teaching involved. There's obviously a lot of golf club design involved. You have to know the golf swing. And at the end of the day, you have to give a great experience to your clients. So it kind of is the perfect hybrid between all of my different experiences. That's how I found my way into fitting. Realized very quickly, very early on, that I was very good at it. I was better at fitting than I was at teaching. I just had
a natural aptitude. Can you be a fitter without being a teacher first?
You can't really. I mean, you have to have an understanding of golf swing mechanics. As both of you know from having spent time with me in the fitting environment, did I ever mention anything swing mechanics to either of you guys? No.
No.
Could I have given you guys tips to make you better? Absolutely. But that's not what we were there for. We were there to
don't hold that out on me, Tim. You know, if you see a way to make me better, come on now.
But
I got to pay for that one.
Absolutely. Got to pay for that. really funny story about Bo Jackson about that. So, but in any event, you know,
you're not going to tell the Bo Jackson story?
Pretty awesome, actually. So a good friend of mine when I lived in Alabama was the punter on Bo's team. This was before they did the NFL combines and all that sort of stuff. So they used to do pro days back in the day. This was when Bo was an underclassman. He's walking across the practice field down at Auburn University. All the seniors are doing their pro day. And so they're out there running their 40-yard dashes and doing all their routes and all their drills. And Bo happens to be walking across the field, and all he's wearing was a set of bicycle shorts. And that's it. No shoes, no nothing. He's just walking in bicycle shorts across the field over to the trainers. And one of the guys says, hey, Bo, you want to run one? And he sits up there and he runs. And legend has it, he ran a sub-4.240. It was like sub-4.18 or something stupid. Barefooted.
I believe it, though. I believe it.
So all the scouts look at their stopwatches, and they're like, there's no way that this is right. And all of this story, by the way, is being told while I'm fitting Bo Jackson for a driver with his punter that was on the team who's telling the story. So it was pretty awesome to have Bo present while this story's getting told. So, and apparently he runs this sub-4.240 in bare feet. All the scouts are looking at their stopwatches. And then they don't believe the time, so they look at Bo. They're like, hey, Bo, can you do that again? And he gets up to the start line, gets ready to go, and they're counting down. It's ready to – the gun's about to go off. Right before they send him a second time, he gets up out of his stance. He looks at the scouts, and he goes, first one was free, fellas. After that, you got to pay. And he walks off the field.
That is classic.
Pretty legendary. So, in your case, Tursky, I'll fit you for free, but if I'm going to give you lessons, you got to pay for them.
That's fair. You drive a tough bargain, but it's fair.
But, so, I mean, how did I find TruSpec? I was working for TaylorMade Golf for some time, doing club fitting with them. There was an opportunity to move back home to Miami, Florida, and take over the TaylorMade facility down in Miami. I was given the opportunity. Unfortunately, between the time I left Birmingham, Alabama, and the time I got set up down in Miami, TaylorMade had lost the contract down at the facility where they were located. So I had since moved and basically didn't have a position. And you know, I get it. Things happen along the ways. And shortly thereafter, the CEO of TruSpec ended up giving me a call, Hoyt McGarity. Since I was supposed to be the guy down in Florida for the TaylorMade gig, it made sense for me to be a candidate for the TruSpec gig. So as they say, the rest is history. That was late 2015. I've been with TruSpec Golf ever since. So it's been a great ride. You know, we started this thing. It was 3 locations, 1 mobile unit. We're up to 25 locations, 4 mobile units around the world. Obviously, this amazing relationship we have with you guys over at Golf Magazine and Golf.com and all the other different interests that we're involved with. It's been an amazing 5 years. So many opportunities and so many different pathways have been presented to all of us throughout these different business units that we work with. It's amazing. So hopefully we'll continue having fun and we'll continue to get to help people play better golf through better gear. And that's always been my goal since I started on the fitting side. what do I enjoy most? That's a question I get a lot. Do I enjoy teaching more? Do I enjoy fitting more? Do I enjoy other aspects? I enjoy club fitting the most. It's instant gratification at its finest.
Me and J-Wall kind of have like a similar job in a weird way. You know, we're helping people get the right clubs in their hands too, just as you do in fitting. We're just trying to do it over the internet, so it's a little bit more difficult. Yeah, but yeah, trying to make people smarter buyers.
Yeah, exactly right. So,
yep.
With that, I think that's probably a wrap for episode 50. So for all of you listeners out there, over the last year that have supported us, DM'd us through our social feeds, suggested different content, everybody that's tuned in to listen to a fully equipped episode, thank you so much from all of us. There's a lot of work behind the scenes that goes into putting this out every week. And, you know, Jonathan, myself, and Andrew, we've been pretty good about making sure that we keep up that weekly cadence. So it's been a great amount of fun to do so. All of our interview guests that we've had in over the last year, thank you for spending time with us. We look forward to continuing to rock on with Fully Equipped. And if anybody has any ideas as far as content, make sure that you shoot them our way. With that, just a reminder over our giveaway on the wedges this week, we've got our Cleveland wedge giveaway, 3 sets of wedges that are going out. We've also got 50% off fittings for all TruSpec customers using the promo code FE50 from now until August 31st. If you're trying to check out more gear content on our social channels, you can find us on Instagram at Fully Equipped Golf. And if you're looking for us on Twitter, you can find us at @Fully_equipped. With that, that's a wrap for episode 50. Thank you all for listening in. We'll see you next week.